Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, my mother never understood my stove. I used to believe it was because she didn't understand me. And of course, I was dead wrong about that. You see, this is my dream stove. It's a hulking commercial range. Well, she wrestled that monster into submission all 89 years, and 5'3" of that woman could cook. But she never failed to tell me how I'd been shortchanged. How could I pay that much money for a stove with no self-cleaning, no light in the oven, and worst of all, no clock? Well, we came to peace over the stove, and a lot more. So today, it's all about moms, their food, and much more this hour on The Splendid Table.
This week's Splendid Table is a repeat of an earlier broadcast.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, any experienced mom is going to tell you that a kid's personality is really the luck of the draw. And maybe this is because food is one of the only areas that a kid can control in their adult-run world. But whatever the backdrop, the family dinner table is a power base. It's the way a little kid tells the world and his mom who he is. Well, writer and mother Emily Franklin has some firsthand experience in this.
Let me state right off that I'm not one of those parents who believes her children to be flawless. I do not profess their untainted personalities to any and everyone, and I do not, upon hearing that my child has called someone a name at drop-off, said something rude to the teacher, or refused to do what everyone else was doing, say aloud, "My child would never do that," because I know they probably did. That said, I adore and relish my children in a way that is nearly impossible to describe, and I accept them as they are and want to help them in areas that are challenging. Some areas are more difficult than others. Take, for example, peas. Peas, those round little vegetables that always seem to me to be happy food. They roll. They're brightly colored, simple finger food, and so easy to prepare. In the summer, even their shells are sweet. Serve them blanched or raw, voila, side of veggies, nothing else needed. Unless, of course, you are my 5-year-old, in which case what you need is not to have to eat the bloody peas in the first place. His eyes widen with terror when he sees the mass of them in the bowl. He scans the counter for proof of another green vegetable, one that would be just for him. I'm not cruel, so if we have some leftover roasted broccoli, I'll sling those his way while the other kids enjoy their peas. I am not, however, a short-order cook, and the rule of the house is that you can eat what's in front of you, or not. My husband Adam, the pediatrician, and I, the experienced mother of 4, are confident that one skipped meal does not a starving child make. If you're really hungry, we tell them, you'll eat it. And if not, that's fine. I'm having broccoli, right? Daniel's hair is golden retriever blonde, his cheeks red from running around the yard. No broccoli, I tell Daniel. Just peas. It would be remiss for me not to give a bit of background information here. If there were an Olympic category for fit throwing, Daniel would medal gold more than once. He is, not to brag, the king of the fit. This is not because of some mean streak. He's not a child who wants to do wrong or seeks to cause trouble. I used to be a teacher, and I'm well-versed in those kids. Daniel just can't control his responses. He feels everything and feels it intensely, deeply, profoundly. Sometimes this is very pleasurable. Example, Mummy, do you know how much I love you? Bigger than every sky sewn together with outer space and all the oceans. Also, I want to live near you and Daddy when I grow up, and I'll have you over for dinner, or maybe just to read to me, even though I'll know how to read by then. I mean, I'll be 18 or maybe 42, but still. Other times, it's less pleasurable. Example, you cut my sandwich. His volume increases. I never asked you to do that. And then more volume. I hate having sandwiches cut, and you know that. And then at the top of his lung capacity, while thrashing his body and turning red, this lunch is horrible. If you were trying to kill me, which I guess you are, this sandwich is the worst way to die. Daniel can throw a fit on a train, plane, automobile, or in any social setting. Much of the time, these outbursts are predictable, and also predictably getting better, as in shorter, as he matures. However, the peas have him doing the slow boil. In fact, Daniel's reaction to knowing he's going to have a big pile of peas just like the rest of his family is very similar to the five stages of grief. The first stage is disbelief. He shakes his head at the warmed dish I'm preparing. I just can't believe it. I can't believe you're making me eat peas. He mutters to himself, confounded and confused. I don't get it. I can't believe this. As the rest of the family filters into the kitchen from outside, the energy in the room shifts. This dinner is really happening. Daniel moves into stage two, anger. Come on, I hate this. Look at my plate. I have way more peas than Julia does, and she likes them. He stomps his feet and glares. We sit down at the table and begin to serve the rest of the meal. Plunging forward into the next stage, Daniel tries to bargain. Okay, I have a deal. I'll eat six. He looks at me and at Adam and then already counters himself. No, 20. I'll eat 20 carrots if you don't make me eat the peas. Daniel, Adam says, you don't have to eat the peas. Daniel looks relieved, but then in seconds knows there's a catch. But if I don't, can I still have more of something else? No. This is all Daniel needs to be bumped right into stage four, depression. He sits forlorn, staring at his plate, unable to sample even the foods he does like because he's so upset by the peas. Jamie butts in, ever the helpful older brother. I'll eat them. I mean, they're just round balls. Julia scoops hers with a spoon. If you don't like them, then just don't eat them. Baby Will sleeps through most of this, dozing in my arms and then Adam's. We pass the rice and talk about spring, about the unfurling leaves and temperatures, the way it still feels part like the season past and part like the hot season ahead. The kids tell us about their art projects and their friends at school, and then Daniel moves slowly into the next big phase, acceptance. His voice is calmer now, but still shaky from his crying jag. How many do I have to eat? Daniel's watery eyes plead his case. Adam and I do the parent check-in, only our eyes meeting. How many do you think you should have to eat? Adam asks, preparing the scoop for Daniel's plate. Daniel breathes out hard, thinking. How about 20? Here's some milk, I tell him. Daniel nods. He has gone from disbelief to exploding with anger to bargaining, sliding into a soft depression, and is now completing the cycle by opening wide and chewing his way through acceptance. I like peas, Julia says and shrugs her small shoulders. Me too, Adam says. Growing up, we had peas all the time. Well, Daniel says as he collects another four and pops them into his mouth. I'm glad I didn't live there. Sometimes it's difficult to believe, my own denial, that Daniel is capable of throwing such huge fits. I could just as easily go through the stages of grief each time he does it. That burst of anger when I know it's actually happening. The bargaining of, please don't do this in the middle of the parent breakfast. The letdown of knowing that it sucks for both of us. And the acceptance of it all. That my stunning, loving, pea-counting child is who he is. A complex twist of DNA and environment whose stubborn qualities, while challenging now, will probably make him a very fine adult. I love you, I tell him, because I always do, even when I'm annoyed or angry or he's just thrown a fit. Daniel looks up at me with a mouthful of peas and milk.
I know.
He swallows. I love you too, but I will never, ever love peas.
Act your age. Don't squirm. You'll be a scientist.
Writer Emily Franklin is author of Too Many Cooks, Kitchen Adventures with One Mom, Four Kids, and 102 Recipes. For a recipe that even Daniel will eat, check out Emily's recipe for the best split pea soup ever. You're going to find it on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there visiting, check out our monthly book giveaway. This month, it's the classic from one of your favorites, Sally Schneider. The book is The Improvisational Cook. Now, you can register to win. Just go to splendidtable.org. If you're fed up with chain eateries and what they're doing to the great local places, you've got to follow Jane and Michael Stern. Now, they bird dog the local all over America. And they tell all on their road food site and here, too. Hey, Jane, Michael, hi.
Hey, Lynn.
Lynn, hi.
I see a mention here that you guys sent. Yucca, Maine.
Bless you.
Do you know what that is?
No. I mean, it does.
Yay. I'm so glad you don't know what
it is.
Well,
let me just tell you that we didn't know what it was up until a few months ago. It's a really rare regional dish, unique to New Orleans. It looks Chinese, like chow mein, ya ka mein.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's more African-American than it is Chinese. And it is found only on the streets of New Orleans. It's not something you'll find in New Orleans restaurants, generally speaking.
It's like truck food or like cart food.
Truck or cart food. And what's great about ya ka mein, this is why we all need to know about it, is that its nickname is Old Sober, because it is allegedly able to not only cure hangovers, but to cure alcoholism itself.
What? All right. What is it?
It's, you know, this is home of voodoo, so why not be able to cure alcoholism with soup?
Oh, it's a soup.
Yes.
Well, it's a soup slash stew.
It's like, you know, oodles of noodles, that thing you microwave.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, imagine
a really good one.
A really good oodles of noodles with spaghetti, spicy broth with lots of Tabasco in it, shredded beef, green onions, and a hard-boiled egg
and
on the top.
And soy sauce. So it's a little Chinese tasting, very hot like you'd only find in New Orleans, and with a lot of protein.
We were trying to figure out the roots of it. And, you know, like so much in New Orleans, it's mysterious. But we were told two things, that either it was brought to New Orleans from African-American Korean War veterans or from railroad construction crew cooks who were both Chinese and black. So somehow the strange mix of oodles and noodles and shredded things and hard-boiled eggs and Tabasco sauce is one of New Orleans' great secrets.
Are there specific places that you go for it? I mean, or is it just something you happen on?
There is one place where we would always go for it, and she's generally in and around the French Quarter. It's called Miss Linda's Catering, and it's a cart. And Linda Green is the woman who makes it. She learned it from her mother, and she's the one who told us its history and also told us its ability to cure a hangover.
People in New Orleans don't really, if you said, where's Linda Green, they would say, wow. You have to ask for the Yucca, Maine lady.
Yes, exactly.
This sounds like it could cure a lot of other things, too.
It's delicious, too.
It sounds fabulous. Yes,
yes, yeah, it's not medicine. It's actually delicious food.
Hey, guys, thank you.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Road Food. Now, you can find their sleeves up dining pics at splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our recipe section. There's a brand new collection we're calling Eating Close to the Ground, and it's designed to inspire you to eat in a more wholesome and earth-attuned way. You're going to find it all, you know where, splendidtable.org. Coming up, what's really happening to real American food? And how to pull off coziness. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. There's a quote about John T. Edge, and it goes like this. To call John T. Edge a food writer is like saying Herman Melville wrote booklets on fishing. John T. is, well, he's beyond the norm. He directs the Southern Foodways Alliance at University of Mississippi. He writes food history, and everywhere he goes, he investigates and he cogitates. Well, last year, he landed a dream gig with the New York Times. It's called United Tastes. Hey, John T., welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. I'm glad to be back.
Now, on the surface, this United Tastes thing looks like the greatest project for a writer, but what is it about?
It's still the greatest project for a writer. The idea is to document the ongoing evolution of American cuisine, plain and simple. It's to look with open eyes at what people are really eating, in what situations they're really eating it, and to pay homage to that in as honest a fashion and straightforward a fashion as I can.
So an example?
An example would be... even in my home region in the American South, to look at biscuits and say, you know, how many people in the South are really baking biscuits these days? How many people are really making yeast rolls? And is Sister Schubert, the kind of enterprising company out of Alabama, is that the secret in everyone's freezer? And, you know, my conclusion is, yeah, it is. To travel to Tucson, Arizona, and to eat the Sonoran-style hot dogs there wrapped in bacon and stippled with mayonnaise and jalapeno sauce and realize that as opposed to the mustard and ketchup standard, that is an American hot dog in Tucson, Arizona. The Sonoran-style hot dog is accepted by you know, whether you're of Hispanic origin or of Anglo origin,
right.
That is an American hot dog in this day.
So let's trace one thing, because now in each piece you look at essentially one food. So an example maybe of one city where you went where you would just track the one food?
Yeah, Seattle is a great example. Seattle, Washington is in many ways an aspirational city. I remember talking to a friend who's a food writer, and I asked her, what is the totemic food of Seattle? And she said, with a question mark implied in her tone, She said, salumi? And I said, yeah, that may be your aspirational view of yourself and your city. But what I saw walking Seattle, what I saw driving Seattle was teriyaki. In strip malls, In fast food bunkers, everywhere I saw teriyaki. I saw salumi at a few places, and it was quite
salumi
good.
Salumi being the pork products from Italy. Yeah, yeah.
Cured pork products from Italy, interpreted most famously in Seattle by Mario Batali's father. And his stuff is wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what working class and everyday Seattle folk eat. They eat teriyaki.
Now, is this teriyaki as it's done in Japan, or is this teriyaki like the hot dog in Sonora?
It's teriyaki as interpreted by, is teriyaki a Japanese dish in origin and perhaps in name, but as interpreted by Vietnamese cooks, as interpreted by Korean cooks, as interpreted by Somali cooks, as interpreted by Mexican cooks.
So in what forms does it take?
Well, the basic teriyaki of Seattle is a chicken thigh, a cutlet, splayed open, cooked over a charcoal fire, and swamped in a sauce of soy and sugar. But I've seen something as derivative, as far flung from the original teriyaki as corn dog teriyaki. It's a late night college kids dish.
One of the things I saw in the piece you did about Seattle is teriyaki as done in the Tokyo Garden restaurant, whose owner is from Nepal and of course serves Japanese food, but it's made by a sushi chef who was born in Mexico.
Correct.
And this is America.
It is. It's America in all its ragged glory. It's America, this kind of multicultural nation that interprets foods, puts them through a sausage grinder, and out the other end comes another food.
You know, this is what I'm wondering is, as you're describing all of this. I'm thinking we have these evolutions going on everywhere as dishes are absorbed and they're changed and all the immigrant groups and all everybody adds their own piece to it. And then you've got the recent immigrants who hang on to traditional dishes, try to keep them, you know, as they were. Or the fanatics like people like me who maybe have none of that heritage, but I'm fascinated by what is a dish like in the homeland. I'm just wondering, are we going to end up being the place in the world with the richest food experiences?
I think we'll be a very interesting place to eat for some time to come. I think there are parallel tracks running, and you described them in some way, Lynn. I mean, I think one is the new immigrant with a conservative sense of their food ways who tries to hang on to what they've left behind. And there's the new immigrant who quickly assimilates, who tries to cook American and sees this place in a way that perhaps someone who's been living here for two or three generations doesn't. The talk of authenticity is an interesting one. I took a lot of heat from people in San Antonio, Texas, and some in Austin, Texas, when I wrote a piece in this series about breakfast tacos. And it was about breakfast tacos becoming kind of the de facto food of Austin, Texas, and becoming an American food. And in writing about that, I wasn't seeking authenticity. I wasn't seeking the best breakfast taco. I was trying to document that moment in which something that we formerly thought of as Hispanic, now we think of as resolutely American. And mm-hmm. that transition point, that moment of transition is what interests me most.
And we have more of that than any other country in the world, in the sense that we have more peoples from more places who have become part of this place.
They have. And there's concern, I think, among those of us who care about food that says, so what are we left with? What is honest? What is distinctive about America? You know, Sid Mintz, in his great book, Tasting Food, Tasting Freedom, he wrote this essay wherein he says, to have a cuisine, you have to have an educated class of eater that recognizes the canon and then defends the canon against challenges that are not worthy of it. And I think he got it right. But I think there's a new canon developing, and that canon accommodates dishes like Nepalese riffs on Japanese teriyaki. I remember talking with a friend, and he quoted an Italian friend of his when we were talking about the same issue. And he said, tradition is innovation that succeeds. Makes sense when you think about America.
It sure does. Hey, thanks for talking with us.
My pleasure, Lynn.
John T. Edge writes the United Tastes column for the New York Times. You know, sometimes you don't realize what you're putting your foot into. A few weeks ago, in one of our weeknight kitchen newsletters, I wrote about how lighting makes all the difference in how you feel when you're eating. I opined that intimacy and relaxation comes from side lighting and candles, never from bright overhead light. Well, then an email arrived from a listener. His name is Jonathan Bean, and this is what he wrote. I read your newsletter this week with great interest because I'm a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley studying coziness. Your advice for how to create a comfortable dining experience was right on for a European or Euro-American audience. Some really fascinating cross-cultural research on Norway and Japan means that you might want to qualify your advice on lighting the dining room. Well, I have to say, between a PhD candidate in coziness and the velvet-gloved challenge, I've got Jonathan on the phone. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what was I off on?
Well, Harold Wilhite's an anthropologist, and he's done a lot of studies on energy use. In one of these studies, he looked at differences in the perception of compact fluorescent light bulbs.
Right.
And he looked at how they were used in Norway versus how they were used in Japan. And it turns out that folks in Japan use them in a completely opposite way to people in Norway. So in Norway, you never want to have lighting overhead. You always want to have light from the sides and lots of different sources of light, so candles and lamps on tables and everything sort of dim. But it turns out in Japan that it's considered natural and normal to be able to see people's faces at the table when you're eating with them. So there, a fluorescent light overhead is ideal for creating intimacy and coziness because you can see people's facial expressions more clearly with a bright overhead light.
Ha! Huh. So that explains why Asian restaurants are lit the way they are.
Yeah.
But I have to go back to something else. You're getting a PhD in coziness?
Yes. It's actually a comparative degree. So I'm looking at the experience of coziness in the U.S. and a particular phenomenon in Denmark that's called hygge, which is usually translated as coziness, but I've learned it means a lot more than that. It's a feeling that's very closely linked with place and interactions. So if I tell you to imagine yourself feeling cozy, you probably are setting a stage in your mind of all of the different things and the places that you would be, probably with dim light for you.
Right.
And it's a way to express this feeling of atmosphere or coziness or comfortableness or intimacy in a lot of different contexts. So I got very curious about what that means and how it might be different than an American's experience of coziness.
So what did you find out?
Well, there are a few things that I think are going on, and I can guide us through setting the scene for optimal coziness or mm-hmm. Danish hygge. So you'd want to first kind of take away any clutter. You want to take away anything in your environment that reminds you of work. So, you know, that stack of bills on the countertop, get those put away or, you know, even better, dim those lights so that you can't see them. And the second thing that you want to do is you want to be able to move around because there's an expression that hygge is sort of fleeting and you can't make it happen. And the best you can do is just sort of let it come in. But you can help it along its way. And one of the things that I noticed a lot in my research is that when you're eating, you're served on trays. So a tray will be set down on a table, for uh-huh. example, when you walk into a dinner party. And if people are congregating around the table and the conversation is getting a little bit trapped,
right.
the host will often come over and pick up that tray and walk around with it and sort of lead people around the room and mix them up with one another so that there's a restructuring of the conversations.
Huh.
And then when you're eating dinner, you'll be passing food from one to another on these trays. And there's a moment that happens, a sort of ritual moment of the passing of the tray and the taking of the food, and eye contact is also involved with that. And then the third thing you would want to do is to have pairs of things displayed. And this was one thing that was really eye-opening to me. I was always taught that odd numbers of things are more attractive,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, in Denmark, it's always twos. So you'd have a pair of candles burning on the table or a pair of photographs.
Why the pairs?
You know, I think that it's sort of a visual shorthand to say everyone here is equally important. There's no hierarchy here. Nothing else is more important than our interactions with one another.
Jonathan, in Denmark, is there any sensitivity about how close people might be at the table?
There is a lot of sensitivity to that. And in fact, it translates into the choice of chairs. So you want to pick chairs that don't have arms and that are lightweight and easily movable.
Mm-hmm.
You would set the table with the place settings closer to one another than they would be typically set in the U.S. And there's a very famous Danish table that's somewhere between a rectangle and an ellipse. And this gets people seated in such a way that there's the erasure of some of the hierarchy that you get with a rectangular table.
No head and no foot, right?
No head and no foot, and it lets you get people even closer because you can kind of wrap people around the corners. And I think that that is one thing that I'm noticing is different from the U.S. We have a tradition of being further apart from one another.
Yeah. It's hard not to talk to somebody if you're rubbing shoulders with them at a table.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jonathan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Lynn. It's been a pleasure.
Jonathan Bean is a PhD candidate at UC Berkeley studying coziness. And by the way, this discussion isn't over. There's lots more to learn here. That elliptical table that the Danes favor, the one that Jonathan mentioned, well, I heartily agree. Everybody can see each other at an oval table and the talk is easy. My complaint is what happens at weddings. Caterers love big round tables. also known as the first best killer of human communication. Now, trust me, if the groom is dying to have you make his Aunt Bessie and her fifth husband, the pool boy, comfortable, it is not going to happen if they're seated opposite you, at least not without a megaphone. Sometimes it takes a while to understand that all mothers do not fit the same mold. It's one of the best things about aging, you know, when we learn to see our parents as actual people. British writer Nigel Slater has written a lot about his family house and his family's take on the dinner table.
My mother is buttering bread for England. The vigour with which she slathers soft yellow fat onto thinly sliced white pap is as near as she gets to the pleasure that is cooking for someone you love. Right now, she has the bread knife in her hand, and nothing can stop her. My mother's way of slicing and buttering has both an ease and an awkwardness about it. She spreads the butter onto the cut side of the loaf, then picks up the bread knife and takes off the buttered slice. She puts down the bread knife, picks up the butter knife, and again butters the freshly cut side of the loaf. She carries on like this till she has used 3/4 of the loaf. The strange thing is that none of us really eats much bread and butter. It's like some ritual of good housekeeping that my mother has to go through. It's as if her grandmother's dying words had been, "Always make sure they have enough bread and butter on the table." No one ever sees what she does with the slices we don't eat. I mention all the leftover bread and butter to Mrs. Butler, a kind, gentle woman whose daughter is in my class at school and whose back garden has a pond with newts and goldfish, crowns of rhubarb and rows of potatoes. A house that smells of apple crumble. "Well, your mum could make bread and butter pudding, apple charlotte, eggy bread or bread pudding," suggests Mrs. Butler, "or she could turn them into toasted cheese sandwiches. I love bread and butter pudding. I love its layers of sweet, quivering custard, juicy raisins and puffed golden crust. I love the way it sings quietly in the oven, the way it wobbles on the spoon. You can't smell a hug, you can't hear a cuddle, but if you could, I reckon it would smell and sound of warm bread and butter pudding."
Nigel Slater read that essay for us from his book, Toast, The Story of a Boy's Hunger. Now, we're compelled to give you a recipe for that ultimate in mommy food, bread and butter pudding, whether your mommy ever heard of it or not. You can find it at splendidtable.org. Okay, it is time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what role does sugar play in a British archaeological restoration project? Well, I'm going to be back with that answer, and I'm going to be taking your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can join us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what role does sugar play in a modern British archaeological restoration project? Well, sugar is actually preserving a bridge. 40,000 tons of liquid sugar is being sprayed over large timbers. Now, they were unearthed in a quarry in Leicestershire, in central England, and they came from a local bridge. a very old bridge. In fact, England's Saxons may have dueled with the invading French Normans on that bridge. We are talking the Norman Conquest in 1066. The timbers are 1,100 years old, and they've managed to survive because they were buried and saturated with moisture. Now the sugar is going to work. Now, it's not very different from preserving food with sugar. If you've ever sugared sliced fruit, you know it seeps into the fiber of the fruit, replacing its natural moisture. Well, the liquid sugar is going to do the same thing for the timbers. The syrup is gradually replacing the wood's water, and it's going to save the timbers from warping. The reason for all this care? The timbers are some of the largest ever found during that period. So now I'm wondering about my back deck. It is time for us to talk. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252 or email us, go to splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. We have got Theodore calling from Royal Oaks, Michigan. Theodore, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, thank you so much for talking to me.
You are welcome.
I just learned, and this is a surprise to both of us, that my fiancé loves cooking. And I have a house that was built in 1912, and the kitchen was redone many times, but the most recent was maybe 15, 20 years ago. And it has a very low-end electric stove. And I'm curious on what you'd recommend as a replacement stove. It seems like these dual-fuel gas-top electric ovens are about the premium out there of what, if money wasn't an object, you'd get, but they are very expensive.
Well, you know, let's talk about the best stove for the money. How much space have you got for a stove? What is it, 24, 30 inch?
I think it's a standard 30.
Okay. First of all, dual fuel, the idea of an electric oven, supposedly it cooks better and whatever. I built a career with gas ovens. First of all, I started out in New York where everybody had gas and you had no choice in those days. You know, if you wanted electric, you had to move to the suburbs.
Okay.
So I don't think you need to really spend that extra money on dual fuel. I would look for a gas range. First of all, you want to have burners that you can easily move pots around. In so many words, you don't want the top designed where the grid that the pot actually sits on is either very high off the surface of the stove or divided by a great deal of space. You want to be able to shift a pot around with some ease. That's number one. Number two, if you have a sealed top, it's much easier to clean, you know, as opposed to open gaps, you know, with the gas burners. The other thing that you want is check the BTUs. This is the level of heat you can get out of each burner. You want to have at least one that's around 15,000, if possible, 17,000 BTUs, so she can have some fast sautéing and that kind of thing going on.
Okay.
The other thing is you want the largest oven that you can find, okay? You do not need convection. If I were buying a stove today, I would like to have the convection as an option that I can flip to because it's great when you bake. But you do not need to spend the extra money on having a convection oven because it can dry things out like roasts and that kind of thing. You want also to have the controls for your burners not on the top of the stove. You're going to burn yourself every time you go to control the heat. You want it in the front and drop down, you know, where you can safely adjust
right.
the
no,
burners.
No, I think that's a must because my older one right now has them in the back, and I've noticed that.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, it's yeah, I know, because I had a stove like that. Wasn't it wonderful? You reach over the boiling water.
Yeah, not thinking that one through very well, were they?
Not a lot, not a lot. And my favorite, the worst stove of all time I had in one apartment was it had push buttons. I couldn't really adjust the heat. I had high, low, and medium.
I remember those from my childhood. My goodness.
Yeah, believe me, this was an apartment from your childhood.
What do you think about the broilers? We looked at one that had a little broiler at the top and then a bigger oven separate below.
No, you want a broiler that's part of your oven, because one of the things you want to be able to do is to put your food up close to the broiler or further away from the broiler. So you just want a broiler that's in the inside of the oven at the top of the oven. And by the way, that's one of the most traditional placements of a broiler, and you will not pay extra money for it. The thing you want from an oven the most is space. For the Thanksgiving turkey, for the two loaves of bread if you decide you're going to bake them, as opposed to a lot of little cubby holes that have all these special uses, but unless you make pizza every night, you're not going to have much luck with them.
Oh, good advice. Thanks.
Okay? Think about how you live and how you cook when you look at the stove, and you'll be home free.
All right. Thank you so much.
And I think it's really generous of you to do all of this for your fiancé.
Well, I love her very much, but it has a trickle-down effect that I'm now eating better than I ever have before.
This is wonderful. I hope you both are very happy together.
Thank you so much. You have a good day.
You too. Bye. You can call us 800-537-5252. We have Nicole calling from Chicago. Nicole, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. So I wanted to talk about stir-fry.
Uh-huh.
I'm a pretty healthy eater and don't always have a lot of time to cook and love stir-fry, but find myself always throwing in the exact same ingredients, and I'm getting pretty bored of it and thought maybe you could help me spice it up a little bit.
Well, tell me what you're doing now.
So I'll usually throw in some garlic, and I stir-fry with canola oil and sometimes some sesame oil. I really like tofu and broccoli and bok choy and peppers.
Right.
But I haven't found a way to kind of, you know, maybe sometimes I'll put in some teriyaki sauce that's store-bought, mm-hmm. but I think there are probably some other things I could do to make it a little more interesting.
Well, if you want to stick with an Asian feel, okay, you're on a great track, but what you can do is, you know how you heat up the wok first and then you add the oil, and then often recipes will tell you to add flavorings to that oil just for a few seconds and then you throw in the main ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're doing garlic. You could do, for instance, thin sliced ginger and scallions, chopped up scallions. And you swish that around in the very hot oil for a few moments, and it gives a lovely, delicate feeling to the dish when you stir-fry it.
Interesting.
And then you could add to the dish, as you're stir-frying, a little hoisin sauce. It has a sweet overtone. It's kind of meaty in a way and very rich tasting, and it gives a delicious flavor. And if you do a little bit of soy sauce, a little bit. This is as you're stir-frying those vegetables you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Toward the end of the stir-fry, you put in maybe a teaspoon or two of the hoisin, a teaspoon of vinegar, okay, and a teaspoon of soy sauce, and just toss that and cook that in. It's really delicious. The other thing to throw in with that is a little chili and a handful of cashews or peanuts.
Right, okay.
And you've suddenly got a whole other deal going on.
Now, what type of vinegar would you use?
I would use a rice vinegar if I were being, you know, Asian and trying to stay with that Asian feel. But it could be an apple cider vinegar, too, because, quite frankly, when you get done with all of those ingredients, you're not going to taste a big difference if you go from one vinegar to another vinegar.
Okay.
And start out with a very little, but you'll get a little acidic touch, which is really nice. It sets off everything else.
Nice.
And then the other thing that you might want to think about is maybe going a non-Asian route. Like, for instance, you heat the wok, you put in the oil, you swish it around, add slices of orange peel, slices of garlic, okay, swish them for a few seconds, add your vegetables to your stir fry, and with that, sprinkle them with ground powdered ancho chili, which is a velvety, slightly spicy, but not very, almost fruity tasting chili powder. And the ancho chili is really delicious. And you put a little bit of that, and with the orange peel and the garlic, it is a delicious combination. And if you were to add just a little orange juice, as you know, toward the end of the stir fry, to get that little, you know, dot of orange juice and maybe a tad of soy sauce, this is a whole other family of flavors.
Wow, that's different. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. You could add ground cumin and coriander with a little paprika, and now you're going into North African flavors. But you're still stir-frying. You know, you're still doing the same kind of thing.
and it's still easy. Now, do you do proteins first or veggies first?
What I do is proteins first. I do a little of the oil, get it really hot. I do the flavoring of the oil. I throw in the protein. I cook the protein, never more than a pound of it because of the size of my wok. My wok's about 16 inches. Take that out, wipe out the wok, add a little bit more oil, and then do the veggies. And then the protein goes back in to get heated up and mixed in with whatever the seasonings might be. Yeah,
great.
That's how I do it. So
fabulous.
So go and experiment.
Thanks.
You have a great time, and thanks for a great question, Nicole.
Thanks a lot. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Remember, you can reach us 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. You know, it's easy to think about where to eat in New York or L.A., but where do you eat in Penang? Robin Eckhart writes about food in Asia for her blog, Eating Asia. She's based in central Malaysia in the city of Kuala Lumpur. Now, that sits midway between Singapore to the south and Thailand to the north. Now, I've got Robin on the phone. Robin, I have been so interested in talking to you. How did you get to Kuala Lumpur?
Sort of by way of Bangkok and Saigon. My husband, David, who takes the photographs for the blog,
right,
used to work in business before he started photographing full-time, and it was his job that brought us here.
What is it like there? What is it like to live there for you?
It feels very normal by now. I mean, this is probably, I think it's about my 15th year in Asia, and it's kind of at the point where being in Asia feels a little more normal than being in America.
Mm-hmm. So what are you eating these days? I mean, let's get down to this. This is what I really want to know, because I think of Malaysia as being this melting pot, because you've got, what, Thailand to
exactly.
the north, mm-hmm. and you've got Indonesia right off the coast.
Mm-hmm.
What is the food like?
It's a little bit of everything. I mean, there's a fairly large Chinese population here, and the Chinese who came to Malaysia a long time ago were mostly from southern China, but there were many different, you know, waves of Chinese immigration.
Right.
So you can have, you know, almost any region of China's food here. And then there's Indian food, mostly southern Indian, because most of the migrants from India were from southern India.
Right.
And then there's Indonesian food. And then you've got this amazing sort of, as you said, melting pot. So you've got dishes that show influence of, you know, China, India, and Indonesia, and other parts of the Malay archipelago all together.
You know what I'd love for you to do? Can you kind of take me on a little tour of your favorite places to eat?
Okay. Well, I'm going to take you to Penang, Georgetown, which is a UNESCO World Heritage Site on the island of Penang, which is in the state of Penang in northern Malaysia.
Okay.
Penang is a really unique place, even for the rest of Asia, because it's still got a lot of on-the-street street food. Hawker food, as they call it in Malaysia, is revered.
Uh-huh.
So let's start out in Little India. It's very vibrant. There's Bollywood hits playing on the street, sari shops and incense burning and all sorts of things. And I want to take you to this stall that sells something called putu, which are sort of tubes of ground rice steamed in bamboo, and the guy knocks it out of the tube,
right.
and then he sprinkles it with fresh grated palm sugar, which is sweet but not too sweet and very smoky because most palm sugar is made over a wood fire. And then I think we should walk about 15 minutes to a dim sum shop, which has been around since 1954. And the servers are going around, not with carts, but carrying by hand these huge, well-worn bamboo baskets. And they come to your table, and they rest the bamboo steamer on your table, and then they lift the lid, and you choose. And my favorite thing to have there are the hagao, or shrimp dumplings. And
I'm beyond hungry, but keep going.
Okay, so then we're going to we should have a little walk now because we've had a couple meals. And we'll walk about 20 minutes to a coffee shop called Tun Leong. And this place has been around since 1922. It's a Chinese coffee shop. And they serve, coffee, which is called kopi in Malaysian. And the coffee here is quite distinctive because they roast the beans with butter or margarine and sugar.
Oh.
And so what you get is a cup of very, very strong, very, very rich coffee with a nice kind of caramel edge. And they usually serve it with sweet condensed milk. And to top it off, at this coffee shop, there is a Nasi Kandar stall. And Nasi Kandar is an Indian specialty of rice with various curries. It's named for the way it used to be sold, which was by an itinerant vendor with pots hanging from a bamboo pole over his shoulder. And Kandar is how you called a pole. And the guy who runs this Nasi Kandar stall makes the most incredible beef curry that just falls apart with the barest nudge of your spoon. You want me to keep going?
I'm going to lose it entirely if you keep
going. We're only on breakfast, okay?
This is an incredible life you lead. Robin, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Robin Eckhart's blog is Eating Asia. She's based in Kuala Lumpur. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. You have a great week, and let me leave you with this thought from Milton Berle, who said, "If evolution works, how come mothers still have only two hands?" The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Now, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.